Hello, I'm very sorry for the inconvenience. We are going to talk about the motion of wind on the surface of the Earth. This is a photo that was taken in the park of a flying Canadian flag from which we got our inspiration. So we are going to talk about how the wind forms on the surface of the Earth and what are the dynamics of the winds and what are the forces that direct the direction of the wind, such as the Coriolis force, and the geostrophic flow, which is actually the equilibrium flow of the atmospheric wind, and a little something at the end. So the primary reason that wind first forms is that the temperature on the temperature of the surface of the Earth is not even. There are variations of the temperature. This is a map of the surface of the Earth that shows temperature at different places. Red means high temperature and blue means low temperature. As you can see, that along the equator we have very high temperature, and as you go towards the poles, the temperature lowers. The variation of temperature creates a variation of pressure. As we can see in this slide shows atmospheric pressure at different places of the Earth. Red means high pressure and blue means low pressure. This pressure variation was primarily created due to the temperature gradient. Where the temperature is warmer, the air becomes lighter and it goes up. So the colder air from surrounding area comes in and fills the gap, and that is how basically airflow is created. This map also shows direction of the air, but that will be explained later, because aside from the pressure gradient, the Coriolis effect also plays a role in the direction of the air. So, what are the governing dynamics of the atmospheric airflow? First of all, there is the equation of continuity, which just says that air can neither be created nor destroyed. Then there is thermodynamic equation, which is basically the first law of thermodynamics, that energy can neither be created or destroyed, it just flows. And there is the momentum conservation equation, which is basically the Newton's second law. Together, these three equations are known as the primitive equations. So this is the equation of continuity. Rho is the air density and V is the velocity of the air. The equation is quite self-explanatory. It says that the density can only change if air is compressed or if it disperses. Then comes the thermodynamic equation. This equation has the specific heat of air. Capital T is the temperature of air. So the left-hand side, at the left-hand side, we have the rate of change of heat, because temperature is multiplied by specific heat, and it is, of course, calculated for unit mass. Right-hand side, we have two terms. The first term is actually the adiabatic flow of heat. So adiabatic flow of heat is basically when the volume changes, although it has a divergence of velocity. It is actually related to the change of volume through the equation of continuity, where we get the relation with the variation of density, which is related to the change of volume. And the second term we have is divergence of heat flux. This actually contains the radiation and diffusion. So air receives heat, it also radiates heat, also it receives radiation from the sunlight, and diffusion is always there. So all are accounted for in the vector J, which is the total heat flux. So the momentum equation is quite well known. It has been mentioned twice before today. This is a Navier-Stokes equation, which is the second law of motion of Newton. So we have P is the pressure of air, F is, okay. So at the left-hand side, we have the change of momentum, rate of change of momentum. So at the right-hand side, we have all the forces. The first contribution comes, of course, from the pressure gradient. And the second is all other forces. So the other forces are, in atmosphere, we have three contributions. First one comes from gravitational force. But this isn't much of a factor, since gravitational force only pulls down the air and it becomes quite equilibrium. It comes to the equilibrium as far as the gravitational force is concerned. And there, and the flow, up down flow isn't that, we don't much experience that. The second term is the Coriolis force, which arises because the Earth is rotating, which will be explained later. And the frictional force, since here is a viscous fluid and it is adjacent to the surface of the Earth, there is a drag force along the surface of the Earth. So that is the frictional force. Capital omega is the angular velocity of Earth. So when the previous three equations are solved simultaneously, okay, so if we consider a simplified model of Earth, where Earth is just a sphere with no features on the surface, we get a relatively simple model of airflow, as we can see in the left picture. But Earth has lots of features, and what we actually end up with is the right-hand side. So this would be the ideal case where we would have air flowing to the equator and to the poles. We have something similar in this picture, but there are some aberrations. So that is the real one. This is the ideal solution. And after that comes the Coriolis force, which will be described by Anthony.
So Nafis mentioned several times the Coriolis force, and let me briefly remind you what it is. So in our inertial frame, we see this black ball rolling directly downward. However, for observers standing on the red spot, it's as if the ball is experiencing two additional forces, the centrifugal force, which our previous presenters talked about, and the Coriolis force. These two fictitious forces are added so that Newtonian physics will work in a rotating frame, which is not inertial. And the force is described by this equation. It's proportional to the cross product of the angular velocity and the velocity of the object moving in the rotating frame. And we should note that the resulting force is perpendicular to these two vectors. In our case, the rotating frame will be the Earth. It turns out that because of the Coriolis effect, wind in the northern hemisphere blows clockwise and counterclockwise in the southern hemisphere. And to see this more clearly, I present these little animation. I didn't make them. You can see the top one. The arrow represents any object, in our case, the wind, but it could be an airplane or something. In our frame, you can see the arrow is moving directly upward. But the resulting path on the Earth is curving clockwise. And same for the second animation, you see that the arrow, its initial velocity is going slightly to the right, but upward. And the resulting path on the Earth is also curving right. And same for the velocity going sideways. It's also curving clockwise. So back to the diagram that is shown, you can see that the little arrows showing the direction of air does follow this clockwise and counterclockwise pattern. And another thing to note is that our Earth is not a plate that I showed in the previous slide. It's a sphere. So in fact, the Coriolis force near the equator is smaller. The effect is smaller because, remember, it is a product of, it's the cross product of the angular velocity and the velocity of the moving object. And on the equator, the velocity of the moving object, which is constrained to the surface of the Earth, will be almost parallel to the rotating axis. And therefore, the Coriolis effect is smaller. And so far, we have described winds on a large scale, basically due to the difference in temperature according to the latitude. However, on regions of the Earth, we can have local low pressure region, and to which air will want to flow into the low region. And this sometimes create what we call the cyclones. on the diagram on the right, you can see the black arrows represent the direction of the air. And as the air tries to blow towards the low region in the center, it is deflected by the Coriolis force. This is in the north hemisphere, so it's all deflecting to the right. And as it continues to deflect, at one point, it's directly against the pressure gradient force. So it creates this equilibrium in which we have this circular shape. Can we use Coriolis force to explain all the swirls, all other swirls we see on the Earth? For example, the tornado, and I've even heard of a myth that toilet waters in North Korea, North America must flow in a counterclockwise fashion because of the Coriolis force. But it turns out that because the Earth is so large and the rate of rotation is so small, like, it doesn't really affect a small and quickly vanishing swirls like the tornado or the toilet water. Yeah. And now we give it to Kim.
Hi. Right, so I am going to describe the geostrophic flow. So, as Nafiz mentioned, you get wind will flow from regions of high pressure to low pressure. And what you'd expect from that is that the arrows of the wind here would be perpendicular to the isobars, lines of constant pressure. However, what you find is far from the equator, down here, that the arrows are almost parallel to the isobars. And I'm going to explain briefly why that is. So, qualitatively, how this works is the wind begins to flow from high to low pressure. However, this causes it to accelerate and pick up a speed. And as Anthony mentioned, the speed, the faster the speed, the more Coriolis force it picks up. So, and this Coriolis force will bend it clockwise in the northern hemisphere, counterclockwise in the southern hemisphere, and will bend it away from that high to low pressure trajectory. And what you find is that it will reach equilibrium when it flows along the isobars. So that's a qualitative explanation. Now for a more mathematical argument. So what we do is we start from the Navier-Stokes equation, as we've said earlier. Here we have forces. We have the Coriolis force, we have gravity, and we have friction, which I've called F in this one. Okay, and so to do this, to mathematically get this geostrophic flow, I'm going to choose a frame, choose coordinates where my x and y are along the surface of the Earth and my z is perpendicular in the vertical direction. And I'm going to give my u this vector here. I'm going to ignore any vertical motion because, as you've probably experienced, wind generally blows along the surface of the Earth, doesn't really go up that much. And so for my purposes, I'm going to pretty much ignore the zero. So in this frame, the rotation of the Earth is given by this. And where phi here is the latitude that you're at. Theta isn't very important. It's to do with how you arrange your x and y axes. You find theta is zero if x is arranged east, but it's not very important. Okay, so in this frame, in these coordinates, if we take the cross product, omega cross u, we end up with omega times get these signs right. It's V sine. So this is our Coriolis force in this frame. Now the Z component, we're gonna, as I said, pretty much ignore. It's gonna be pretty small compared to gravity anyway. So we can kind of not really worry about the z component. But if we take the x and y components, we get two equations. We get du by dt equals f. I'll define f in a minute. Fv is it minus 1 over rho dp by dx and dv by dt equals f u minus 1 over rho dp by dx, where I'm going to define f equals 2 omega sine phi. So f is known as the Coriolis parameter, and as you see, it's a function of latitude, 0 at the equator and getting bigger as you get towards the poles. Now, we're going to consider the equilibrium solution, so we're going to ignore these. We're going to ignore the time derivatives here. And if we then rearrange that equation, we end up with these equations of motion, equations for the x and y component of the,
That's assuming you are not at the equator of the Earth, right?
You run into problems at the equator because f will be zero.
Right.
But other than that, I haven't really assumed too much. Okay, so as I said, x and y, we're free to choose. So I'm going to choose my coordinates so that x runs along the isobars. And in that case, you'll see dp dx goes to zero. And so if we ignore friction for the moment, you'll then see that v goes to zero, but u doesn't. U goes to something non-zero, which means you end up with your velocity being proportional to 1, 0, 0, i.e. the flow goes along the isobar. If you start to take friction into account, you see that that's no longer the case, and friction becomes increasingly important as f gets small, i.e. when you get near the equator. And this explains why far from the equator you follow the isobars, whereas close to the equator you've got the perpendicular flow, as you'd expect. Okay, and that basically sums up geostrophic flow. Briefly, before we finish, I want to quickly mention the hairy ball theorem. And this is most famously described as you can't comb a hairy ball without creating a cowlick. So you can try and comb the hairs on a ball, but you'll always end up with things like this, poles at the top and the bottom. What I was interested to discover when I was researching this is you can actually do it with only making one pole, and you end up with something a bit like this, where you've got like a, when it comes around, it's like a dipole field there. But you always have to have at least one pole. And how this corresponds to the wind is the wind can be thought of as those hairs. It's like a vector field that covers the whole Earth. And purely from topology, we see that we must have at least one place on the Earth's surface which has no wind. And as Anthony explained, if you've got no wind, that's a place of low pressure, you will end up with a cyclone. And so purely from topology, we find we must have cyclones. Any questions?
I have a question. You say that purely from topology, we gotta have cyclones, but I guess the vector field, you consider wind as a vector field in the sphere, which is obviously not the same every time, right? So does this imply that every day of the year you will find a cyclone anywhere in the Earth?
You must find at least one point on Earth with zero wind, and that corresponds to a cyclone. It doesn't have to be as big.
All right, right.
It won't necessarily be as big as this one, but there must be. Nico?
How do you know that the point with zero wind has to have a non-zero curl?
Yeah, purely from the Coriolis force, from what Anthony was saying. The point of zero wind, the low pressure, as the wind flows towards it, it will be deflected. Yeah, Jason?
Do you have any idea why hurricanes are like a North American phenomenon? That like, or that there's certain like weather patterns that are local just to like specific regions of the earth.
Yeah, for like tornadoes.
Or I guess like so like you would get a you get like hurricanes just if you look at the Atlantic Ocean you get hurricanes like on one side but not that's true. They're like they're no.
Say it's probably. What
are you asking
go
how it's formed?
Why? I'm asking why in a particular place.
Yeah, why is there certain like
so maybe not that one.
The pressure one.
Yeah,
oh,
where's the pressure?
That
one
was in June, right?
You already
right.
You went through it.
Sorry.
Stop.
Yeah, there we go. Okay. Yeah, so I think it's to do with this probably. You get big pressure, big variations in pressure, and that's probably which is kind of intrinsic to the. To the nature of the land masses.
The pressure zones are not as uniform as the temperature zones because of the features of the surface of the Earth. The oceanic flows and the mountain ranges create some extraordinary features for the wind flows, which contributes to the pressure. So there are some local features that are attributed to the local material.
No other questions? Let's thank our speakers again.